Welcome to KPTZ's Nature Now, a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of kptz.org.
Hello, and welcome to Nature Now. I'm your host, Nan Evans. Today, I'll be talking with Jim Bodkin. Jim is a scientist emeritus with the U.S. Geological Survey. Jim recently retired to Port Townsend after a long and very impressive career with the federal government as a research wildlife biologist in Alaska with the U.S. Geological Survey. Jim's an expert on coastal marine ecology, marine conservation, and especially the population biology and ecology of marine mammals, such as sea otters. So welcome, Jim.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Before we check on local observations and talk with Jim, let's hear this week's mystery sound. But first, Jim.
Here are a couple of listening hints. You can hear the waves in the background along with the calls of seagulls. But listen for the rhythmic series of chirrups and chips, and those are the mystery sounds.
So now let's listen. Well, we'll tell you what that was towards the end of the program. But right now, sort of looking around our area, and what kind of naturalist observations do we have?
Well, if you have a hummingbird feeder in your yard, you're probably now seeing the Anna's hummingbirds. The Rufous hummingbirds have long left the Pacific Northwest for their southern wintering territories. The Anna's hummingbirds have successfully extended their range northward from California and are now found all year long in the Pacific Northwest. The male Anna's are splendid in their iridescent emerald feathers and sparkling rose pink throat and crown. These colors are not pigmented feathers, but rather they are the structural colors, which means they are reflected by microscopic structural features of the feather's surface. Basically, the feathers are composed of multiple complex layers of tiny air bubbles. When light strikes the surface of the feather, some light is reflected from the outer surface, and some light travels through those air bubbles and reflects off the inner surface of the bubbles. Light, with wavelengths that match the thickness of the air bubbles, are amplified as the reflected waves from the inner surface match up and combine with the reflected waves from the outer surface. The combined reflections from the inner and outer surfaces of the air bubbles creates the iridescent colors.
Last week, on a blustery cold day, the hardy members of the Jefferson Land Trust Natural History Society took the ferry to Whidbey Island, where they explored the cliffs up toward the Admiralty Head Lighthouse and then walked back along the rocky shore. The bird highlight of the bluffs was a group of about a dozen California quail. But the beach provided the real surprise. Wendy Feltham sent me a picture. A bright, very bright, orange sea pen had washed up on the rocky shore. Sea pens are actually relatives of sea anemones and jellyfish and corals, but they don't look like any of those animals. The orange sea pen resembles a bright orange, sort of old-fashioned feather quill, and it sits in a bottle of orange ink. They're found on mud or sandy bottoms, ranging from about 45 feet to 700 feet underwater. Sea pens bury about half of their body into the substrate and then wave the other feathery half to capture plankton from the water. And then overall, the orange sea pen can grow to about a foot and a half tall. They're actually colonies of tiny polyps like corals. And in addition to being a bright orange, they can produce a luminous blue-green light. It's called bioluminescence when they're disturbed or threatened. Now thinking about the hummingbirds, of course, I'm curious to know what produces that bright orange color. It could be a pigment produced by the animal, or perhaps, like the pink of pink flamingos, it comes from something they eat. You can sometimes observe orange sea pens in the larger aquaria, such as the Seattle or the Monterey Bay Aquaria. They're really actually quite cool and unlikely creatures. I talked with Jim here on Nature Now earlier this year, and we talked about sea otter biology and ecology. And if you'd like to listen to either of those programs, go to the KPTZ website, that's kptz.org, follow the link to past podcasts, Then select Nature Now from the pull-down menu and search for the keywords sea otter. Today, I'll be talking with Jim in much more detail about the sea otter population right off the outer coast of Washington. And this idea to bring Jim back in sort of got generated from some of the news last summer where there were sightings of these huge rafts of sea otters out in the ocean, sort of in the Ho River area, I think is where it was. And I'm remembering a statement from a Fish and Wildlife Department person saying it was probably the largest raft of sea otters they'd ever observed. So first, Jim, rafts. What are they? What are the animals doing in those rafts? Tell me a bit about them.
A raft is a term that's used to describe a group or an aggregation of sea otters, and it can be a small number, or just a raft of two or more might be the smallest.
So I'm sort of picturing like a log raft. They're kind of next to each other.
Sure.
And hanging out.
And those rafts can go in size from typically from just a few animals to a few dozen animals. And they're typically consist of a group of females and their dependent pups and possibly a territorial male that this group is within. Some of the largest groups that have been seen number in the thousands, probably 1,000 to 2,000 animals. And we've seen those in various locations, typically where animals are recolonizing new habitat that they were extirpated from during the fur trade 100 to 250 years ago.
I'm sort of recalling the number 1,000-ish as being the number of animals in that raft this summer. Is that about right?
Yeah, I think it was several hundred. The current population size on the west coast of Washington is now numbering about 1,500 to 2,000 animals. These were some of the largest aggregations that have been seen in Washington.
One more question about rafting. Is there an adaptive advantage to rafting, or are they doing something together, or what is it?
They're a very social animal, sea otters, and they have a lot of social interactions. They communicate with each other verbally as well as through their sense of smell. They're mustelids, so sense of smell is critical to their behavior and to their social organization. When a new animal comes into a raft, typically what they'll do is they'll go around and they'll smell every individual that's in that raft. And it's a kind of a way of greeting and recognizing one another. So that raft is integral to their behavior and to their social structure. And these animals tend to rest together with other individuals that are known to them. And we know this by kind of the marking and tagging programs that we've done, where we see animals with the same tags that are rest with each other, you know, day after day, month over month, and year after year. These are long-term
sort of
relationships.
Social relationships.
Absolutely.
Interesting. Well, you mentioned, and I think we all probably know, that the sea otter population off the coast of Washington, off the coast of most of the Pacific Northwest, was decimated. Can you review a bit for us just the story of kind of what we know about that pre-decimation, what caused the destruction, and then some more information about the reintroduction of those sea otters off of our coast?
We don't have very much information about sea otter populations before the fur trade, which started in the mid-1700s and ended about 1900. What we know comes mainly from harvest records, which are somewhat crude estimates of distribution and a relative abundance because they bring the animals to a central location. Astoria, I think, was one of the main collection points for the fur trade in the Pacific Northwest. There are records. We know that some of the last sea otters taken from Washington were taken from some of the bays. Grays Harbor and Willapa Bay, I believe, were some of the last recordings of sea otters in the state.
And that was very early 1900s.
Correct. The other source of information comes from midden sites.
Okay, define a midden for me.
Well, a midden site is a kitchen midden, and it's the remains of communities, of peoples from their waste products, fires, and cooking and things like that. They leave the hard parts, so to speak. You can go back and look at those and determine, what the individuals that live there were consuming and taking or using. Right. And it's interesting because sea otters are rare in the Eastern Straits, in the Salish Sea. They're there, but they're less common than we would expect if sea otters were abundant at the time those middens were established. Conversely, on the outer coast, sea otters are much more common. We don't have a good deal of knowledge about kind of the distribution and abundance of sea otters in
before the fur industry.
But one thing that we do know is that virtually every other habitat from central Baja California to northwestern Alaska and across to the Aleutian Islands and into Russia is that sea otters occur in every nearshore coastal habitat. Mm-hmm. So it would be as surprising if sea otters didn't occur in the Salish Sea and in Puget Sound.
But we just don't have the information, that's what you're saying.
Right.
And I remember I was in school at the University of Washington, in grad school, in the very early 1970s. And there was this mysterious talk about there's been a reintroduction of sea otters off the West Coast, and it's a secret where they are. I was studying biological oceanography, and I really wanted to know where they were. And of course, nobody was telling because it was an experiment and it needed to be secret. Tell me about that reintroduction.
There was a number of reintroductions that took place along the West Coast into Southeast Alaska, Oregon, British Columbia, and Washington. And I think there was about 90 animals that were brought into Washington from Amchitka.
That's an island off Alaska.
Up in the Aleutian archipelagos, right. They were released there, and as typical of most of the reintroductions, there was a fairly high mortality and dispersal immediately following. So we suspect that the founding population of the Washington coast translocation probably was on the order of a dozen or a two dozen animals. So it was quite small.
So that sort of raises an immediate question. Are scientists at all concerned about that small gene pool or the effects of inbreeding with only a dozen or so individuals to begin with?
Yeah, that's been a concern for probably ever since the translocations, but even prior to that, you know, what was the effect of that fur harvest, mm-hmm. of that maritime fur harvest on the molecular genetics
right.
of sea otters. And then on top of that, we have these reductions in population size, very small numbers of founding into these translocations. So there's kind of two sources there, population bottlenecks, if you will. And quite a bit of work has been done. Some of it been done most recently by Sean Larson with the Seattle Aquarium. And she did some work basically extracting DNA from sea otter bones from middens, mm-hmm. that occurred before the fur harvest.
Hmm.
And so we can
– she could do some comparisons.
Right. So she was able to take a picture, so to speak, of the genetic structure before the fur harvest. And she found that basically from – depending on which metric you looked at, but sea otters lost 30% to 60% of their genetic variability as a result of these two bottlenecks that they encountered.
That seems huge to me.
It is. It does seem huge. And there's examples in other species of adverse effects from severe, mm-hmm. population bottlenecks. Some of the cats in particular. Cheetahs were one of the early examples. Many species that have undergone reductions in genetic diversity have recovered and demonstrated healthy growth rates in their populations. And sea otters are one of those
species. That seems to have been the case. I mean, that
right.
Washington population, you said now, is probably what? Couple thousand?
It's getting close to 2,000 animals.
From maybe a dozen or so.
Right.
So that seems to me that's been, what, 50
almost
years?
Almost 50 years.
Wow. It sort of seems that that's a real success story. What do we know about the population growth rate and compared to, I don't even know if we know what kind of a normal population growth rate would be, but talk to me about that.
Washington in particular had fairly high growth rates. I mean, they had a negative growth rate immediately following. But in the first couple of decades, they were growing at about 20% a year, which was higher than any of the growth rates that we saw in remnant populations, but equivalent to growth rates for other translocated populations. And those were from Southeast Alaska and British Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
So they were pretty consistent in those growth rates and consistent with those other populations as well. The growth rates have now started to decline. So they're still around 9% in British Columbia and in Washington. And in Southeast Alaska, the growth rates, that was a much larger translocation, mm-hmm. and the growth rates there have moderated significantly in some areas down to single digits.
So is that what you would expect to see in a translocated population? A successful one. It peaks and then drops back again.
And it's very much dependent on kind of, the reproductive biology and the life history of sea otters. They have a very small home range, and they have a high site fidelity to that small home range. And that's not necessarily conducive to rapid expansion over large spatial scales. In other words, if a species like the sea otter has a limited dispersal capability, if it can only disperse, let's say, 100 kilometers, you know, once that distance from their birth place to unoccupied habitat kind of exceeds their dispersal distance, then we're likely to see a reduction in the rate of increase in those populations. And that's probably what we're seeing in most of these translocated populations now, a kind of a density-dependent reduction in the rate of growth.
Okay. I'm thinking about the population. It's growing. They're, as you said, they have small home ranges, lots of site fidelity. How does it expand?
What we've seen is that abundance builds up in a fairly small area. And this is what we've seen in Washington. It hasn't been kind of a uniform increase across the landscape, but rather from Cape Flattery down to just off the Hoh River now is kind of the area of distribution of sea otters in the state. And there's lots of unoccupied habitat. And I think that the fact that they don't expand quickly into that unoccupied habitat speaks to the importance of the social structure of the population. Most recently, in the 1980s, we took 142 sea otters out to San Nicolas Island off the coast of California from an area that where food was limiting, and we took them to an area where food was abundant.
And so it wasn't food.
It wasn't food that was driving their behavior. It seems more likely that it was that fidelity to their home range and their behavior that was driving their behavior as opposed to the need for food.
Food or shelter or whatever.
Yeah, shelter doesn't seem to be an important need for sea otters. They occur in virtually all of the coastal habitats that we're aware of, from open coast into protected inland waters, into bays and estuaries. San Francisco Bay, there were maybe upwards of 10,000 sea otters in San Francisco Bay.
Interesting. So are the sea otters off of our coast the same species as what you see like in Monterey Bay and—
There's a single species of sea otters that occupies the North Pacific from northern Japan to, Southern
all around
California
the Pacific
now,
Rim, right? Essentially.
Yeah. And there's three subspecies that are recognized primarily for management purposes, and they're distinct in terms of their geographic distribution now. The animals in Washington belonging to what is known as the northern subspecies that occurs north of here through Alaska.
So it's a subspecies, and then within that subspecies, you have these tight-knit social groups.
Very much so.
Yeah. This happened before, Jim. We got talking, and just like, this is so interesting, and so many questions come up. But we're running out of time. So will you come back?
Sure, I'd love to.
Great. So we need to do a couple of things. First is to listen to that mystery sound again. Well, that was the chirping, I guess is how one might say it, of the ancient murrelet. This small, plump water bird has a black face and crown, gray upper parts, and white markings on the neck, throat, and underparts. Plus, it has a very short, pale yellow bill. And that, I think, is the distinguishing field mark with the murrelets. The ancient murrelet is related to the threatened marbled murrelet that we find in old growth forests, but ancients are widespread throughout the North Pacific. Ken Wilson recently spotted two ancient murrelets diving for fish very close to shore, right behind the Quimper Mercantile. So go out and have a look. Let's see. We now need to look forward for the next week or so. And Jim, will you help me share what's coming up?
Sure. Everybody's invited to join Admiralty Audubon Christmas Bird Count on Saturday, December 17th. This Christmas Bird Count is an organized continent-wide survey which documents every bird seen on a given day from sunrise to sunset. The count is an all-day event. It's open to anyone wishing to participate. Half-day participants and home feeder watchers are also welcome. And for more information, you can check with the Admiralty Audubon Society's website.
And I'll let you listeners know that the week after Christmas on Nature Now, I'll be talking with Monica Fletcher, and she'll be talking about what they observed at the Christmas bird count. So that's the week after Christmas. Well, back to Saturday, December 17th. Later that Saturday is movie night at the Dungeness River Audubon Center in Sequim. Playing is a film entitled The Sonic Sea, about the sources of sound in the sea and its impact on animals, especially whales. This is actually a very good film. I saw it when it was playing earlier here in town. More details on movie night are available on the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society's website.
And then on Wednesday, December 21st, we're going to encounter the winter solstice, the longest night and the shortest day of the year in the Northern Hemisphere. Many people consider the entire day as the winter solstice. However, the solstice is actually a specific moment in time when the sun reaches its southernmost position as seen from the Earth. The sun is exactly over the Tropic of Capricorn, which is a latitude of 23 degrees and 30 minutes in the Southern Hemisphere. The sun seems to stand still that moment, and the term solstice comes from the Latin word solstitum, meaning the sun stands still. And this year, that exact moment will be at 2:44 a.m. in Port Townsend.
2:44 a.m. on Wednesday, December the 21st. Okay. So, that's it for this episode of KPTZ's Nature Now. I'm your host, Nan Evans. I've been talking with Jim Bodkin, and I hope you've enjoyed our program of authentic, eclectic news and information about the natural community where we live. Do contact Nature Now hosts if you have comments or observations or ideas, or even if you think you might be interested in joining our team of hosts. It's great fun. Email us at naturenow@kptz.org. Nature Now airs at noon on Wednesdays, with repeats here on KPTZ at 91.9, on Thursdays at 5 p.m., and Saturdays at 11:30 a.m. Recent podcasts are also available on the KPTZ website. Thanks for listening.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Lisa Hannigan performs today's closing music, Song of the Sea.
Between the ear, between the now, between the north, between the south, between the west, between the between the